Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Our guest today is Doug Irwin. Doug is a professor of economics at Dartmouth College and is one of the leading experts on trade economics and has published widely on the topic in both journals and books. Doug has a new book titled Clashing Over Commerce, A History of U.S. Trade Policy that is hot off the press. Doug joins us today to talk about his new book and some of his work on the Great Depression. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, you're one of the few guests who made a recurring appearance, and we're excited to have you here. In fact, you're live in the studio this time, so it's neat to have you back on board. I want to talk about your book, Clashing Over Commerce. It's a sweeping history of trade in the U.S. Give us kind of an overview of it, and then we'll kind of delve into more specific parts.
Well, it covers the history of U.S. trade policy from 1763 right up through Donald Trump. So it is quite massive in terms of its scope. And what I've tried to do is the last really big history of U.S. trade policy was done by Frank Taussig, who was a great economist, a Harvard professor. He was the first chair of the U.S. Tariff Commission in around 1919 or so. And he wrote a book called The Tariff History of the United States, which is a great book. But his last edition was in 1930, and we've had a lot of history since then. And we've learned a lot about the period he was writing about in terms of cleometrics and economic historians going over data. And I thought, I didn't write this because of Trump. I've been working on it for many years. But it just so happens it's coming out at a moment where people are sort of, you know, talking about trade once again, and even the administration brings up figures from the past, Andrew Jackson and Alexander Hamilton. So I sort of lucked out in terms of the timing, but it's just to provide sort of an overview of the political and economic history of U.S. trade policy from the founding of the country to the present.
Yeah, and you had a recent Wall Street Journal article we'll talk about as well that kind of plays off of that. But I think it's very topical today. But even before Trump and all that, there's at least in my view, an ongoing confusion over trade policy. It's always something that's hard to explain. It's easy to maybe fall into protectionist tendencies. So it's a never-ending struggle, I guess, for you as a trade economist, right? You have many books that kind of make this case.
Right. But the point of the book is not to make the case for or against trade. It's really just to say how did things evolve? What were the economic and political factors behind whether tariffs are going up or down or we're moving towards being more open or less open? But you're absolutely right. There's always there's a perennial debate over trade policy. And in fact, I opened the book with a quote from James Madison writing in the Federalist Papers saying, you know, we're going to have these clashes within a country, differences of views, difference of interests over trade policy. And he said, to what degree should we be protecting domestic manufacturers from foreign competition? He said, there's no one way of answering this question, and it's going to be one of a political struggle. And so the book is really about that political struggle, about whether tariffs should be higher or lower, should we have protection or be more open and closer to free trade.
All right. So what are some of the major themes of the book?
Well, I sort of divide the history into three periods, and I call them the three R's, revenue, restriction, and reciprocity. And when you think about what can a government use trade policy for, one is we're talking about taxes on imports pretty much, tariffs. Mm-hmm. And so you can use those to raise revenue. You can use those just to block imports to protect domestic firms from foreign competition. Or you can use it as a bargaining chip to achieve reciprocity in a level playing field or something like that. And we see each of those three things throughout U.S. history, but you can really divide the history into three eras where one of those is sort of the predominant motive of driving U.S. trade policy. And, you know, we're talking over, you know, 200 years of U.S. trade policy history, but these periods of either where the revenue is most important or restriction, protectionism is most important or reciprocity, they tend to be very long periods and there's a lot of status quo bias within them. And so I talk about sort of the structural features that lead to the status quo bias, why it's very hard to deviate from the status quo in any one of these periods. Then the question becomes, how do you shift between these periods? And there's sort of these big shocks, which we can get into. One is the Civil War, which leads to a transition from revenue to restriction. And then we have the Great Depression, which leads to a shift from restriction to reciprocity.
Yeah, it was fascinating looking at these three regimes, these three R's, that there was so much continuity for such a long time for each of those. I guess that was a little surprising to me. Was that a surprise to you, or is that well understood in the literature.
It was a little bit surprising. You know, there's the, I don't know if you've seen the HBO series Veep, with, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, but, it's a fictitious program. Obviously, she's the vice president, then becomes the president. She has this campaign at one, time where her, slogan is continuity and change. And of course, that's hilarious because you can't have continuity and change, but actually that's a description of U.S. trade policy because the continuity is that within one of these periods, there's, as I mentioned, tremendous status quo bias, but it's never an accepted status quo. There's always a challenge. There's always a political debate and tussle over what direction policy should be. But then the changes, we do get these abrupt changes in the regime types. But I think the structure, the status quo bias comes from the fact that, you know, when we have a certain trade policy regime in place, any change is going to be taking something away from someone. And so there's great political resistance to doing that. So when we have a regime of high tariffs from the Civil War up to the Great Depression, to reduce those, Mac Dessler of the Peterson Institute once had this great quote from someone saying, it's an unnatural act to reduce those because you know you're who you're going to hurt. And who's going to benefit, it's going to be a little bit more diffuse. And so politicians won't act that way. And in fact, what's sort of interesting about the current regime, which where we have low tariffs and we're in with Trump, is he's finding it a little bit difficult to raise tariffs because he's finding there's resistance. You're also going to be taking away something from when you have low tariffs. And yes, you're giving something to someone, but you're also hurting others and they don't want to deviate from what we have right now. So there is the status quo bias, I think, in politics.
Like with Steele and Trump, right?
Exactly. So it sounded very easy on the campaign trail to say, yes, we're going to protect Steele jobs. But all of a sudden, when you have power and you actually have the, you know, the potential to do that, the Steele users, exporters, are worried about retaliation against their products. So agricultural, states are opposed to that. And all of a sudden, the opposition sort of comes out of the woodwork and it's not quite as easy politically to do it.
It's been fascinating to watch. I had Caroline Froen on the show recently, and we talked about how all his talk about changing trade really hasn't, you know, manifested itself because it has been more challenging. He's realizing, or at least his staff is realizing, that there's many parties involved and there's winners and losers. And even TPP, there was an article that came out in Politico, I'm sure you saw, where all these farmers had invested massively in expansion because they believe they're now going to have all these foreign markets open to them. But now Trump pulls out a PPP. And these are the folks who voted for Trump. And they're kind of like, why did we vote for this guy?
Exactly. And that came up with NAFTA, too. So there's in April, I believe, the president thought, you know, it's time to pull out of NAFTA. And he's going to do this very precipitously. And once again, the Secretary of Agriculture and a lot of the members of Congress from ag states called or wrote to the White House saying, don't do this. You know, we depend on exporting to Mexico. We'll really be hurt if you do this. And, you know, when you think about the political debate over the last year, NAFTA's just gotten this horrible bad name. It's, you know, really been beaten up, you know, loss of jobs, this, that, and the other thing. And now finally went, okay, so let's get rid of it. Well, wait a second. No, you know, there's a lot of opposition to doing that because those pro-trade constituencies tend to be relatively quiet.
Who would have thought? It's complicated.
Right? It's complicated. That's right. Yes. It's not just
like
healthcare.
With healthcare.
Right.
Where he said, who would have thought it's complicated? Yes. Well, let's get into these three periods, which are, again, summarized by these approaches to tariffs. The revenue period, which I believe is 1763 to 1865. Then there's the restriction period of 1865 to 1932. And the reciprocity is 1932 to the present. Let's start with the revenue one. Tell us, how does that section start, that period start?
Well, actually, it's sort of interesting. Once again, the book has as much political history as it does economic history. Mm-hmm. And even I hadn't quite realized how much we owe the Constitution to trade policy in some sense. under the Articles of Confederation, Congress couldn't levy taxes. It was dependent on requisitions from the states. And so one of the reasons for having the Constitutional Convention that Madison and Hamilton and others wanted was that the central government needed to pay its debts. And it could only pay its debts if it could raise taxes. And so import tariffs are the most efficient way of raising taxes back in the post-colonial period. You know, we didn't have W-2s. The income tax wasn't sort of feasible. Even sales taxes would have been evaded and very hard, difficult to collect. But imports just come into, you know, half a dozen major ports in the U.S. You can just tax the goods right there. So all the founding fathers recognized that tariffs would be the main way of raising revenue. We need to give Congress the power to raise revenue. We need a constitution that'll enable that. So we got the Constitution which gave Congress that power. And the second act that Congress passed was a tariff act to raise revenue. It was the way of raising funds to pay debts. So the debate was all about how high should tariffs be to raise revenue, and so that was really a key consideration just in terms of the political founding of the country.
So Alexander Hamilton wasn't a protectionist. He was just someone thinking more about raising revenue for the government.
Yeah. So there's sort of this image of Hamilton wrote in 1791 the report on manufacturers. And, of course, that's a famous, justly famous report. It's incredibly well argued, very sophisticated reasoning. But he does say that we should be promoting manufacturers. And that's sort of a key word, promotion rather than protection. And so he really wanted subsidies and other prizes and tournaments to encourage manufacturing in the United States. He didn't really want to raise tariffs or block imports to any significant degree. And certainly the way he acted as Secretary of the Treasury, he resisted a lot of pressure to raise tariffs to very high levels to protect domestic manufacturers because he was first and foremost concerned about funding the debt and making sure the federal government was solvent. And imports were the tax base. That's the thing you want to tax. And you don't want to shrivel up your tax base through high protectionist duties. You want to keep a steady flow of imports coming in and then just levy, an efficient tax on top of that to garnish as much revenue as possible. So he so resisted some pressure from import competing manufacturers, which were a very small group back in the day, that they started shifting towards supporting Jefferson and Madison and people you'd sort of associate with less government and laissez-faire, perhaps, but they were also had a much greater anti-British animus and were much more willing to strike back against Britain through high trade barriers.
I see.
And so that's why we had an embargo. We had a lot of trade measures against Britain, not under Hamilton's rule as Secretary of the Treasury, but under the Jefferson and Madison administrations.
We talked about this last time you came on the show, but it's worth repeating. So the Jefferson embargo was truly an embargo, right? It truly cut off the rest of the world, and it was devastating for the U.S. economy, right?
Right. So basically, the reason is U.S. shipping was getting harassed by the French and the British navies. We didn't have much of a navy to provide maritime protection. So Jefferson said, well, our alternatives are war, and we don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or we just pull all of our ships off the seas. And so basically the embargo was any American ship in port couldn't leave to export goods, and any U.S. ship that was already on the seas could come back, offload its goods, but then couldn't travel. And this was in effect for a little over a year. And you could just imagine, think about President Trump saying, we're not just going to have higher tariffs. We're going to have we're just going to stop trade for a year and get rid of the trade deficit that way. No trade. There's a pretty, a major step. Obviously, it wasn't so much for economic reasons under Jefferson. It was more for security reasons, but it had a devastating effect on the economy. You can imagine we're a very trade-dependent economy back then. You shut down all the ports. You're not going to be very popular in Baltimore and in Philadelphia and in Boston and elsewhere. And so there's a lot of pressure for by the end of that year, 1808, to smuggle goods out. It was irresistible, but it took draconian enforcement measures. I've estimated that the welfare cost or GDP cost was about 5% of U.S. GDP in 1 year. And when you think about the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, I mean, how much did GDP go down in the U.S.?
About 3%.
3%?
Yeah.
Maybe even a little less than that. We're losing 5% in 6 months.
Yeah.
So this is just a major impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah. So is far worse than the Great Recession then? This impact. Do you think that's, just kind of stepping back, was that embargo the most costly trade experience we've had, or would you attribute it to another one?
The thing about the embargo is only for about a year.
Okay.
And it's hard to compare different periods because obviously the circumstances are different. But when we declared our independence, Britain enforced an embargo against us. And we had a non-trade sort of act against them. And when you look at U.S. trade from 1775, right before the Declaration of Independence, when we basically stopped trade, up through the Treaty of Paris, which was 1783, and then trade was resumed between the U.S. and Britain, that was a good long stretch, 5, 6, 7 years or so, where trade was either not zero, but at very low levels, partly because there was a war, partly because of policy. And that economic historians have looked at as being a really devastating period for the U.S. economy. Much worse, it's been said, than the Great Depression. Very, very difficult times.
That's interesting. All right. So during this period, there does arise regional conflicts over tariffs, and there's the famous tariff of abomination. So tell us about that development.
Sure. Well, you're certainly right about one of the themes of the book is that you can think about U.S. trade politics as being a competition among regions for which policy we're going to have in place. So the South tended to be much more export-oriented at this time. We were exporting a lot of cotton, obviously, tobacco, and other things. So it was sort of the export platform for the United States. The North was had more industry, which was facing foreign competition. And so the question is not just during this period, but throughout history, how the different regions have had different economic interests and how that plays out in Congress. So even though I've said that the period before the Civil War was one in which revenue was sort of the dominant concern of Congress, there's always protectionist pressure. And in the 1820s, this came about with Henry Clay, the American system, trying to raise tariff levels to help out manufacturers in the United States. And it sort of culminated in what became known as the Tariff of Abominations, which is raising tariffs actually to very high levels in 1828. It was largely for political reasons. It really wasn't for economic reasons. And so it gets to another theme of the book, which is that politicians sometimes use the tariff for their own purposes. It's not as though they are the instrument of special interest groups. So there's the sort of stereotypical public choice view, which just uses politicians as mimicking or reacting to economic interests. I find a number of periods in U.S. history where it's the other way around. Actually, politicians are using economic interests for their own political ends. And the Tariff of Abominations is an example of that because the U.S. economy was not being overrun by imports. We did not have a high unemployment rate. The economy was doing pretty well. So there's no, in some sense, demand for higher protection, but the politicians want to use it sort of for their own political purposes. And so what that did was obviously raise tariffs to very high levels. The South and South Carolina in particular had extreme objections to this, said it was unconstitutional. We might leave the country as a result of it. It caused a big political crisis in the United States that wasn't diffused until 1833.
So going into the Civil War, tariffs were going down then, right?
Yeah. So once again, there is this North-South conflict over tariffs. Absolutely. And the 1820s is sort of the heyday of that. This is when John Calhoun comes out with the rights of secession and the ability of states to sort of veto national laws, blanking on the precise term that he had for that. But a lot of conflict. But the point is that the South won that battle with the Compromise of 1833. So you sometimes hear, well, because of this North-South discord over the tariff, that was one of the causes of the Civil War. It wasn't just slavery, or even some people say it wasn't really slavery, it was really the tariff. And I just don't think that's true. The South won the battle. The 1833 Compromise brought tariffs down in a phased out way. The tariffs were cut again in 1846. They were cut again in 1857. And by the outbreak of the Civil War, 1860, the average tariff is less than 20%, which is basically where the South wanted it. So the South won that battle. Yes, there had always been North-South conflict, but it was really had been diffused by 1860.
Well, this is good to know because, as you said, this often comes up in discussions about, you know, was the South unfairly harmed by tariffs, and was that something that led them to fight the Civil War? But you show pretty conclusively that's not the case.
Right. Now, certainly the South was harmed by the tariff, particularly in the 1820s, and economic historians have done calculations about what the burden was. It's not very high as a share of total U.S. GDP, but one can understand why there was an grievance. But that grievance had been, was gone by the 1840s, 50s.
Were Southerners in the 1860s or late 1850s, were they still sore over the tariff abominations? Did they say, look, they did it to us once, they could do it to us again? Was that maybe in the back of their mind?
Well, there's always regional jealousy. So I'm not sure the South worried about the tariff coming back, but they certainly worried about interference with slavery and public works. The South was very much against internal improvements because all the internal improvement spending was going to take place in the North and the Midwest, not in the South. Yeah. In terms of building canals and things of that sort. So there's always regional jealousy, but the tariff matter had by 1860 pretty much evaporated. Now, the one sort of caveat is that Congress passed in 1861 the Morrill Tariff, which raised tariff rates. But the reason that went through is because after the election of 1860, Abraham Lincoln, the South walked out of Congress. And so then the remaining Northerners could pass that tariff. Mm. But if the South had stayed in Congress, they could have stopped that.
Okay.
So sometimes they'd say, well, they raised the tariff in 1861. That would have hurt the South. But that was sort of, the South had already walked
causality
by that
point. Wrong.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So that gets us to the second phase of trade history. And that's the restrictionist phase. And this is one of the first exogenous shocks you talk about, right? Something big. So we have this trajectory for trade, and all of a sudden this big shock, the Civil War comes and puts us on a different trajectory. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So once again, as I said, by 1859, 1860, tariffs were at pretty low levels. And if we had not had the Civil War, presumably that would have continued for some time. And it would have been very interesting to see how the U.S. would have developed in the late 19th century under a relatively low tariff regime. But we have the Civil War, and the North needs to raise revenue. It's a massively expensive proposition. They introduced an income tax, all sorts of excise taxes, and of course the tariffs go up to sort of compensate for the increase in excise taxes. So tariffs go up. There's no political opposition to that. It wasn't done for protectionist purposes. It was really to raise revenue for the war. But when the war is over, the question is, well, can we bring those tariffs down? And first of all, you can't do that immediately because you have to pay off all the debts. The tariff revenue did not nearly come close to paying for the whole war. And second of all, you've built up all sorts of special interests behind the tariff wall now. And so they're going to resist. In fact, they did resist any sort of cuts in tariffs. So that's where you get sort of this, not just a status quo bias, but you get this ratchet effect where once they come up, they're not going to come back down because there's vested interest behind them. And that's really the story of the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s of everyone sort of recognizes the tariffs probably should come down. We have huge fiscal surpluses. The protection is considered pretty extreme, but politically it's just impossible to bring the tariffs down.
So these are the Republicans, right? That why were they so protectionist? I mean, just pure, they ran the industries. What was their motivation?
Yeah. So once again, it all comes down to regional representation. So the political strength of the Republicans was coming from the North, which is where a lot of manufacturing is.
Okay.
And so they don't want imports coming in. And the Democrats are largely in the South, which is still export oriented. And they want lower tariffs. But the North was much more politically powerful in the post-Civil War period. So it's just regional interests explain it. But even the few times that Democrats get in, and they really didn't have many political opportunities, the Democrats were divided. Yes, the Democrats in the South want to cut tariffs, but a lot of Democrats in the North, they would deviate from their party. They had represented constituencies in Pennsylvania and they didn't want tariffs cut. So you have the Republican Party strongly unified behind protection, and then the Democrats are divided between the North and the South, and so they're sort of ineffective as a force to bring tariffs down.
So you mentioned the debt being one of the issues that tariffs stayed high, in addition to these protectionist impulses. I wonder if there's any overlap there, though. Like the Republicans saw it as a convenient excuse to keep them up, and then they kind of segued into, well, we keep them high for our business as well. Was there any of that, do you think?
Oh, there's a huge issue during this period. In fact, there's something called the Great Tariff Debate of 1888.
Okay.
About what should we do with our fiscal policy with respect to trade in some sense. So the issue was, I called it a fiscal crisis. It was a major fiscal crisis in the sense that the U.S. had these fiscal surpluses, which were just astronomical. The government was taking in $2 for every $1 it was spending. And, you might think, why is that a problem? The Republicans tried to spend their way out of it a little bit through Civil War pensions, but still the money was just coming in. And, there was a Laffer curve debate during this period. So the Democrats said, well, since we have the surplus, the obvious, solution is to cut taxes. In other words, cut tariffs. And the Republicans said, no, if we cut tariffs, that'll encourage more imports and we'll get more revenue. So we have to raise tariffs to reduce the revenue. Wow. And so what's interesting is Republicans and Democrats always seem to be on the opposite side of the Laffer curve, where Democrats think that raising or lowering tariff rates would raise or lower revenue, and Republicans think that if you raise tariffs, you'll reduce revenue, and if you reduce tariffs, you'll raise revenue.
Poor Art Laffer. He thought he was the original one who wrote it on a napkin. But
right. That was really the debate in the 1880s.
Interesting. Well, I bring this up because I'm a little bit familiar with this period in terms of some of the monetary issues. And one of the things they had during that period was the national banking system, which was introduced at the time of the Civil War. And the amount of money that if you're chartered under a national bank, and most of the banks became national charters, they had taxes that kind of taxed the state banks out of existence until the late 1800s. But so a lot of national banks and the money they issued had to be backed by national bonds, government debt. And so the amount of money that could be issued was literally tied to the amount of debt there was. And as you mentioned, the debt's going down during this period, which caused problems for the amount of money supply, very rigid, inelastic money supply. And as you know, whenever the farmers went to harvest, there wasn't enough money around. And so they had to adjust the law several times because the national debt was going down.
Right. And that was one of the big worries by the end of the 1880s was that the Treasury will just be accumulating all this surplus, drawing it out of the banking system. And if we extinguish the debt, what's going to happen to, you know, the money supply and capital
for
lending?
It is a unique set of problems we never have to think about today.
Right.
I mean, it's really a different world, different set of circumstances. I mean, another interesting thing about this period, because I've looked at it a little bit, is also this postbellum deflation period where, you know, for almost 30 years, you have sustained decline. Some of it's severe during these 1870s, 1890s downturn, but there's a overall secular decline in prices as well. There's the agrarian revolt against this. There's William Jennings Bryan who appears on the scene.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I imagine some of this has to overlap with the trade issues then, right?
It is sort of, indirectly related.
Okay.
Certainly, politicians would use these arguments. So the protectionists would say, look, tariffs don't cause higher prices. Prices are falling. But that's the price levels falling because of deflation. It's not as though the tariff leads to lower prices. So that it's sort of, you know, the arguments get muddied in that way.
Yeah, very fascinating period. A lot of structural change going on, obviously, during that time. All right. I think the end of the restriction period takes us up to the Smoot-Hawley during the early part of the Great Depression. So tell us about Smoot-Hawley. What was its motivation? What effect did it have?
Well, that's another example where there's no real demand by constituents or by the private sector for these higher tariffs, but politicians are using it for their own political purposes. So, you know, this period very well is that, you know, 1929 was a boom year. Unemployment rate was, you know, only about 3% or so. The stock market was rising. This is the roaring 20s. The economy is doing very well. We don't have big trade surplus or trade deficit. There's no real trade problem, but there was sort of a farm problem. And Calvin Coolidge had twice vetoed price support legislation the Republicans in Congress had proposed. And so the issue was, how do we help farmers? And so Congress latches on to the tariff and says, well, let's raise the tariff on imports as a way of helping out farmers. First of all, farmers weren't enthusiastic about that because we were a net exporter of most farm goods, not so much for sugar or wool, but for, you know, grains and everything like that. We're a big exporter. So a tariff wouldn't help them on that. And once they sort of opened that up for revision, that's when the manufacturers came in and said, okay, well, you know, we want higher tariffs too. And so once again, it really wasn't economically necessary. There was no demand for it at the time, but we just got this big increase in tariffs, really before the Great Depression had tipped into it, although Smoot-Hawley wasn't passed until the June of 1930 after we'd sort of entered into the recession. But it always was already baked in the cake, so to speak, by the summer of 1929. So it was sort of unnecessary, gratuitous piece of legislation that had, you know, huge consequences for the U.S., the Depression, and moving forward.
Now, most people don't say that it was the main reason for the Great Depression, but it definitely added, you know, injury to insult, right? It definitely added salt to the wound, made it worse than it would otherwise have been.
Right, because there was a lot of retaliation against the U.S.,
okay,
both explicit and implicit. And so the biggest retaliation came from Canada. And so that's where this really sort of backfired against the U.S. in terms of even farm exports. Mm. So there's one example that Cordell Hull used to always point to is that we imposed a higher tariff on eggs, but we were a huge net exporter of eggs. And what Canada did was sort of match our tariff on eggs. And so our exports plummeted to Canada in terms of eggs. And so it just didn't help out egg producers or chicken producers at all.
Wow. That period was really one of colossal policy errors on many fronts.
And it wasn't just tariff barriers were raised against the U.S., but they're largely discriminatory. So Canada went in for imperial preferences, giving preferences to British manufacturers over ours. So did other countries. And there's really the rise of discrimination as much as the rise of trade barriers overall, which was damaging to the U.S.
So did Smoot-Hawley, it was retaliatory, other countries responded. I mean, did it really create a big shock to the global trade apparatus, to the trajectory of global trade?
It was just one of many steps taken during this period. So obviously it backfired against the U.S., but when you think about the trade wars of the early 1930s, I'd say an equally problematic issue was when the financial crisis really hit Europe in 1931, and then Germany and Eastern European countries began imposing exchange controls. And then Britain Britain devalued or went off the gold standard in September of 1931. That led to a lot of retaliation against Britain because now they had a quote unquote undervalued currency. And so other countries that stayed on the gold standard wanted to impose special tariffs on Britain because of that and the whole British sterling block. So things really unraveled in 1931. So yes, the U.S. is sort of there's retaliation against the U.S. That all happens in 1930 or so, but 1931 was sort of the denouement of what moving into the Depression, really bad trade policies with exchange controls and other things coming to the fore.
Okay. Now, as bad as this discussion is, it ultimately served, the Great Depression itself served as a major shock, right, to push us back in the other direction.
Right, yes.
Which is a little bit counterintuitive because in our previous conversation, we talked about how recessions often make people more protectionist. Like Trump comes out of the Great Recession, the populism in Europe, Ross Perot in the early 90s. So this is, help me understand this. How did this push us in a more healthy direction?
That's a really good way of putting it because it is sort of unusual. But I think the fact that we just tried protection and was followed in its consequence or in its
trend. It's very clear and vivid.
Exactly. So you don't want to try more of that because it didn't seem to work out. And you mentioned that you know, we now don't think that the Smoot-Hawley tariff caused the Great Depression, but a lot of people at the time sort of did. And it was sort of post hoc ergo proctor hoc. You know, what happened? We had a stock market crash and we imposed these high tariffs and then the economy goes to pieces. Well, what could have caused this? You know, they didn't have the monetary interpretation back then so much. And it was, well, it must have been the stock market crash and the higher tariffs that caused it. So that's the first real sense in which tariffs got a bad name in, among the population. And then the fact that, you know, we just tried this trade policy experiment. It didn't really work out. We don't want to double down on it. We have to think about something else. And I think here's where the retaliation is also key, because that was, you know, discriminatory against the United States. Our exporters all of a sudden began to wake up and take notice, saying we're being locked out of foreign markets because of what we just did. And so when Cordell Hull and the Roosevelt administration comes in, Cordell Hull was the Secretary of State who had wanted to move us in a different trade direction. They made it their mission to reduce the burdens on U.S. exports in other countries. So that's where this idea of reciprocity came from.
Very interesting. So hopefully we won't have to repeat that mistake
right
under Trump. But as we said earlier, Trump has found that it's more complicated than some of his rhetoric. But
also this gets back to the theme that you know, sometimes it's not just special interests driving things. Politicians can drive things, because when Cordell Hull said we want a policy of reciprocity, it's not as though that's what all the export interests were demanding. He sort of had that policy innovation in his head and pushed it. And then the export interests came behind him and said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. We'll support that.
Okay.
But once again, it wasn't the interests leading the politicians. It was the politicians leading the interests.
So not to be cynical or anything, but do you think politicians today could be that exogenous force?
At certain points in time. Once again, I haven't sort of, you know, can't identify all the conditions under which political entrepreneurship really works, but there are certain points in time where it does.
There's still hope for
There's still hope, yes.
I mean, I say that because today there's, you know, there's social media, there's Twitter, there's 24/7, you know, cable news. There's just seems to be, again, this is just my anecdotal, probably wrong impression that politicians are much more sensitive to, you know, their environment, where this would require them to have a spine to kind of put a step forward, and hopefully the masses would follow them. So it's still possible what you're saying.
It is. And in fact, I think we see that today with the Jones Act, which is shipping restrictions that we've had since the 1920s or so. And once again, economists always said, why do we have this? It's protectionist. It's very costly and inefficient. And now we have – there's sort of this crisis – where we can't get goods to Puerto Rico very efficiently. And so there's an opportunity. Senator John McCain and others have said, let's make the exemption permanent for Puerto Rico, if not abolish it. And so we're having a debate now about the Jones Act, which before was sort of, you know, impervious to criticism. And now it's sort of obvious what the costs are. And so there's this opportunity to possibly get rid of it. Not saying that's going to happen, but at least there's this opening.
But there's a hope that it might. And I guess kind of comparing this to the Great Depression, then you need both a policy entrepreneur and some kind of shock.
Right.
Kind of perfect storm of things lining up. Some people can see, you know, what damage the Jones Act does, as well as someone who's willing to take the lead.
Exactly. And we could just see what the damage was from Smoot-Hawley because of the discrimination against U.S. exports. So it made it demonstrable, tangible. It wasn't something abstract.
That's fascinating. The average person realized, man, these trade wars are bad. They've harmed, even if the interpretation was partly wrong.
Right, right.
So, you know, even though, you know, as the monitors at heart, I regret that it took so long for Milton Friedman's message to get out, but maybe that's one positive side effect, that because we didn't really have the correct understanding, it led to another understanding, which led to more trade liberalization.
Right.
Kind of a weird twist of fate there. Okay, so this opens up this shock. The Great Depression puts us on another trajectory toward more engagement in the world. Did our foreign policy also play a role in that?
Yeah. So, Cordell Hull, as Secretary of State in 1933, in 1934 in particular, sort of introduced into Congress this idea of reciprocal trade agreements. And it sort of, changed it changed the locus of U.S. trade policy from the Congress to the president. So Smoot-Hawley was the last time Congress passed a long trade bill specifying the rates of duty on imports on every, 3,000 items in the tariff code. So Congress gave that up. Now it's it can be set by the president in the context of negotiations. He can declare a proclamation reducing tariff rates if the trade agreement had been reached. Now it has to be subject to congressional approval, of course, but not initially. And so it didn't, wasn't a game changer in the 1930s, but it did move us in a different direction. And the game changer was really World War II, where the U.S. saw and both political parties saw that we can't fumble the peace after World War II the way we did after World War I. After World War I, we didn't join the League of Nations. We raised tariffs again. We became isolationist, and we have to go on a different path. So trade policy was sort of bound up in this new foreign policy for the United States of openness, engagement, leadership in the world. And one of the areas of leadership was trade. And so after World War II, that's when we get the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, where we don't reach these smaller bilateral agreements that were reached in the 1930s, but we have a bigger multilateral architecture for reducing tariffs around the world.
Now, was the World War II experience, the lessons that you mentioned, the League of Nations, all these issues that push us further in the direction of more engagement with the world, more trade, was this something widely understood by like the average American, or was it just more of the policy entrepreneurs who understood this and ran with the idea?
I think it was widely understood at the time. Okay. So even up till 1940 or so, the Republicans – were opposed to Cordell Hull's policy in reciprocal trade agreements, and I think in the their election platform in 1940, they said that they would repeal the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act and go back to the old system. After the war, they didn't say we'd go back to the old system. They'd say we want to modify it in certain ways, but they sort of went on board and accepting the way things had moved. And sort of the key Republican figure there was Arthur Vandenberg, a senator from Michigan, who was sort of isolationist in the 1930s, but by 1943 or so, it basically said, the world's changed, we have to be engaged, and we have to support these trade agreements.
Well, that's remarkable, such wide-based support for trade policy, whereas today you see it kind of going in the other direction. And of course, we've had the China shock, we've had globalization, and which can maybe taint that, but it's fascinating there can be such wide based support for trade.
Well, it's a very unique period in U.S. history for about 20 or 30 years after the end of World War II, where there's this bipartisan consensus. And it really began to break down after the end of the Cold War. So for foreign policy reasons, that brought the parties together in terms of trade. And it's really the only period in U.S. history where the parties really agreed. The whole book is just littered with Republicans attacking Democrats and vice versa over which direction trade policy should go. But in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and into the 80s, there's, they're squabbling over trade. There's issues, but pretty much everyone's on board that we have to keep the system open. And with the NAFTA debate, that's the first time we really see some big divergence. And of course, that's post, Cold War. About is this good for the economy? Before it would be posed as it's good for the economy because it's helping out our Western allies and building up, strong economies against communism, Western alliance and all that. And now it's not so much we care about the alliance, it's we care about ourselves. And that brings out sort of protectionist pressures in a different way.
Very interesting. Well, we can thank the Soviets then for promoting trade in the U.S., right. At least the Soviet threat. Okay. So much to this book. I mean, again, I really encourage our listeners to go out and get it. It's out right now as this podcast is being placed. Make sure you get your copy ordered. This kind of brings us more up to the present, as you mentioned, NAFTA. And you had it. So to kind of bring this forward and tie it to the present, you have an article just came out a few weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, and it was titled Steve Bannon's Bad History. So a lot of what we touched on is in this, but tell us, how does he get his history wrong?
Well, economic nationalism has always been a theme in the U.S. context. And in the 19th century, we had, protectionists saying this is America first trade policy and all that. So what the economic nationalists today, and Steve Bannon, I guess, is sort of the head of that, and Trump in terms of his instincts sort of buys into it, is that Our wealth has been sucked out of us. This is what Trump said in his inauguration address. You know, protection will preserve our strength. We've wiped out the middle class, and the American economy has been sort of the zero sum game where they've gotten rich and they've got rich at our expense. And so there's a narrative among the economic nationalists appealing to history and Hamilton and Andrew Jackson, and saying, you know, they put America first, and we grew into a rich economy behind high tariff walls. And that's really not the case, at least in terms of the way I and other economic historians have looked at it. First of all, the U.S. has always been a pretty rich country. So Jeffrey Williamson and Peter Lindert have a recent book looking at American wealth and GDP way back to the colonial period. And we've always been a very rich country, which is one reason why we've been a magnet for so much immigration throughout the 19th century. And they say that we actually were much overtook Britain much earlier than other economic historians had thought. So we've always been a very high-wage, wealthy economy. Prior to tariff walls, prior to industrialization. And then when we look at the post-Civil War period, when we had very rapid economic growth, economic nationalists will say, well, we had high tariffs then, and we grew really rapidly, ergo one caused the other. But it's really not the case. We grew very rapidly because we had a lot of immigration coming in, so the labor force was growing very rapidly. We had a lot of capital accumulation because the National Banking Acts you were pointing out earlier, particularly in the 1860s, allowed the formation of a lot of banks, particularly in the Northwest, in the Midwest, where they could, you know, efficiently channel savings into productive investment. So capital accumulation was very high. But that capital accumulation wasn't so much in manufacturing. It was in structures, building, infrastructure, things of that sort. And in fact, it was really the service sector in the late 19th century was absolutely key to U.S. growth. It wasn't manufacturing. We are already fairly large as a manufacturing power. Obviously, it grew a lot, but it didn't really grow a lot as a share of GDP. The whole economy was growing. And in terms of productivity and just sheer innovation, a lot of it was occurring in the service sector, not manufacturing, which is the one that you typically think is being protected by high tariffs.
So what it is, they make the mistake of confusing correlation with causation during this period. You're seeing this rapid growth, which happened to occur, rapid industrialization, rapid service sector, really, you highlight rapid service sector growth. And then they see these tariffs and they go, this must cause that. But it's completely backward.
Right. And this is not a unique occurrence. So we talked about, you know, Smoot-Hawley, the Great Depression. People said, well, we imposed these tariffs and then we had the Great Depression. Therefore, tariffs caused that. But we also imposed tariffs right after World War I. And we didn't have a depression after those tariffs in 1922. So, you know, fundamental econ 1 point, correlation is not causation. You have to dig deeper and really figure
and
out
I hate
the
to,
mechanisms.
I hate to pile this on, but I think it's a point worth stressing because not only is it this casual empiricism lead to these false conclusions, but even some serious scholars, and I know I mentioned his name last time, and I feel bad bringing it up again, but I think it's important, like Ha-Jun Chang has written a whole book about this where you've written about how he gets the causation wrong. Just because something's correlated does not mean it's causal.
Right. Now, it could be, but you really have to explore the mechanisms and tell us why it's happening. I'm just saying this happened and that happened. That's really superficial analysis.
But all the things you just raised, all the developments going on inside the U.S., it's a much easier story to tell than the one they want to tell.
Right.
Okay. In the time we have left, and last time we were on the show, I did not get to do this or give it justice anyhow. I want to talk about the Great Depression a little bit more, in particular the gold standard, because you have a fascinating paper that's titled, Did France Cause a Great Depression? And you look at – and this is more of a monetary paper, so we're moving from trade more into monetary economics. You've written several interesting papers. You've written on the initial Great Depression as well as the later recession, 1937-38. But let's talk about the initial Great Depression, and you conclude that, France did help. France was an important part, at least, of the story for the sharp contraction, the early part of the 1930s. So how did France help cause the Great Depression?
Well, first of all, I should say this isn't original to me. I was really just building on the insights of, first of all, Milton Friedman and also Clark Johnson and Scott Sumner.
Yep.
So Milton Friedman, in a preface to an English translation of the governor of the Banque de France at the time, sort of said, after reading this memoir, if I could rewrite the monetary history, I'd change it a little bit and say France was partly responsible for the Great Depression. And then Clark Johnson had a great book on this period as well. And so my paper is just sort of following up on that work. And basically the story is, and this seemed to get missed in a lot of discussions about the origins of the Great Depression, is obviously the world was on the gold standard. And France, when they went back on the gold standard in the mid-1920s, pegged the franc at an undervalued rate. So they had a trade surplus. They were absorbing gold from the rest of the world, and they didn't sterilize it. And so what happens is the gold just kept on flowing in, and sort of like the U.S. was to some extent. But if when you look at the numbers, it's just the gold acquisition was just massive. It really hadn't been sort of noted by other economic historians. And so I just want to say, you know, what sort of deflationary pressure could this possibly have exerted on all the other countries by absorbing this huge quantity of gold? In fact, in researching the paper at the time, I was going through some old New York Times archives online, and there's one report where, I think it was in the New York Times, where the Bank of France had to dig out its basement deeper to accommodate all the gold that was flowing in. They just had no space for it.
That's crazy.
And, you might have the numbers at your fingertips.
Yeah,
that's enormous. And
I believe if I read these numbers correctly, so 1926 they had 7% of the world's gold supply. By 1932 they had jumped to 27%. Does that sound right?
Something like that. And
yeah.
that's astronomical.
That's a huge increase.
Enormous.
Close to a third of the world's gold supply suddenly ends up in France.
In one country. That's not even, you know, one of the major players,
right. And then on top of that, of course, as you mentioned, you also mentioned in your paper, the U.S. did a little bit of this as well. They were also cheating. Gold inflows were coming in to the U.S. and they weren't allowing the prices to rise correspondingly, right?
Exactly. And so that's what sterilization means, is if the gold came in and you monetized it, you increased the money supply one for one, then there would be a natural balancing act. Prices in France would have risen, the trade surplus would have declined, and it would have, you know, equilibrated naturally. But they didn't do that. So they're really demonetizing the whole world by acquiring gold, but then not, you know, playing by the rules of the game and inflating.
That's a good point, to be clear to our listeners who aren't economists, that this mattered because the money supply was determined by the amount of gold. So you can think of maybe, you know, the money supply, the money multiplier, all that was tied to the amount of gold. So if you suddenly suck up a bunch of the gold out of the world market, global money supply is going to go down. That's why this was the global Great Depression.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And so I trace sort of the world price level to what's going on in France and try to apportion blame, if you will. I'm holding up quotations to the United States and France. And France basically almost equals the United States in terms of its impact on sort of the deflation of the world economy.
In your paper, you mentioned between France and the U.S., at least half of the decline in the deflation, 1930-31, can be attributed to those two countries. So had they both been responsible – And to be clear, they may have been a catalyst, a trigger, and then there's these other cascading, the stock market and panic and everything else ensues. But had that catalyst not been there, it could have been a very different outcome.
Absolutely.
So, so this goes back to a conversation I've had with several other guests, and this speaks to the interwar gold standard, why it did not work well. When you compare it to the classical gold standard, which was like 1870, 1914, it worked relatively well, comparatively well at least. But this interwar one did not. And so, the classical gold standard process you just described, if gold came into your country because your goods were cheaper, more competitive, more gold, more money, eventually your goods got more expensive and then gold would flow out to the other country, it was now cheaper. And so that process was allowed to work. In the interwar period, it was not created the Great Depression. So the question is why? And your co-author, Barry Eichengreen, have co-authored before. He has a great book, The Golden Fetters, and he makes the case in there that by the time you get to the interwar gold standard, there's more enfranchisement. Voters are more cognizant of this process and politicians are more sensitive to this. And so you're bound to have cheating. You're bound to have, countries not tolerating the pain of the gold standard. Is that your view too?
Oh, sure. And here I defer, completely to Barry, who's done the seminal work on this. It was not an automatic gold standard on automatic pilot. It was very much a managed, politicized gold standard. In fact, it was called the gold exchange standard because it was sort of watered down. You could use foreign exchange reserves as part of your central bank reserves in addition to gold.
Yep.
So it was just very different than the pre-World War I gold standard. Although I think economic historians have gone back and said the pre-World War I standard was not quite as pure.
Not as hunky-dory as it.
Exactly, yeah. But nothing like the interwar
period. But what it, again, it made a distinction is, though, to the extent it did work, before 1914. It would have meant, you know, that if prices were cheaper somewhere else, the gold flows out of your country. You have, you know, a period of monetary, you lose your money, prices fall, might be painful. You had to tolerate more pain.
Right. So
you had to suck it up, you know, and, you know, maybe tolerate a mild recession. But that, what you did is you preserved international order at the expense of domestic, you know, stability. You had more recessions domestically, but the international debt, you didn't see any sustained trade deficits. But by the time you get into the war period, it's just politically not possible to do that. Now, George Sell, I brought this up with George Selgin, and he goes, oh, it's the central banks. They're the ones they were managing. But I would argue they were managing because of this political economy now that, you know, yes, they had to manage the gold standard because there's this expectation that it will be managed and we'll first and foremost worry about our domestic economy over the international one, which I'm saying all this to get to my big question. Does it seem likely you could do a gold standard today, given the political economy that we saw during the interwar period?
Well, I think not. The demands on government to ensure domestic economic stability take priority over any external objective.
Yeah.
So actually, Michael Bordo and Anna Schwartz have a nice paper in the Open Economies Review, I think it's called, just this conflict between domestic objectives and international objectives or external objectives, and how that conflict will always be resolved in terms of the domestic. And so it's just you can't say, well, you know, we're going to suffer a recession because we're going to maintain a fixed exchange rate or, you know, the value.
I mean, we see that today, don't we, right? We were talking earlier before the show about like China. China ran current account surpluses of 10% of GDP.
By 2008, their current account surplus.
I mean, so they were massively, you know, sucking demand out of the world. They had a massive effect on the rest of the world. The U.S. is running a huge current account deficit. But China was thinking about themselves, right? They have all these people from the countryside moving to the cities. They got to employ. I'm sure they're sensitive on the margins to what's going on outside the countries, but it's not like the gold standard. They're first and foremost, let's keep our people happy.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the challenges in making something like the gold standard work again. Well, let's get to, it's a very fascinating period. And you read papers like yours about France, the Great Depression, the gold standard, Barry Eichengreen's work and others. At least in my mind, this will sound very, you know, maybe egotistical. I think you can't do history without economics. You can't really understand trade. I mean, trade, the money system, all these things are so important to understanding what happened in the 19th century, the U.S., right? I think it's two disciplines that really complement each other. But let's go to your paper on the second recession within the Great Depression. So we had the 1929 to 1933 contraction, and there was the 1937-38 recession. Tell us the standard interpretation of that, and then what's your kind of unique angle on it?
Well, the 37-38 recession is a fascinating one because that's actually the recession that converted a lot of Americans to Keynesianism. Because it seemed like the government was cutting back on raised taxes slightly, cutting back on some expenditures. We had this, you know, very deep recession within a depression, really interrupted the recovery. It was basically a U.S. phenomenon. It wasn't a global phenomenon. And so Alvin Hansen, for example, that's when he sort of became converted to Keynes. And the standard interpretation was fiscal policy sort of had caused that. But then Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in the Monetary History and others said, well, they were raising reserve requirements during this period. The Fed was. So there's a monetary aspect to it. And so there's been this debate about, you know, was it raising the reserve requirements or some fiscal actions? But when I got into it, I can't remember exactly how I got into it. I think I got into it because after the Great Recession, people were worried about a double dip.
Okay.
And so 1937 was being brought up again and again as you know, how can we ensure a smooth recovery? Which begs the question, well, what happened in 1937-38? And the reserve requirements, they weren't that big a movement. And so the question is, how can you have this really big recession from this relatively small change? And so I found out, just through reading that the Treasury Department started sterilizing gold imports. So the U.S. was a net recipient of gold from the rest of the world during this time. So we should have had nominal GDP rising. They were worried about inflation when, you know, inflation is like 3%, 4%.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. And so they tightened by sterilizing gold imports. And so this is astounding because what that means is even though gold continues to come in, it doesn't become part of the monetary base, and the monetary base just becomes flat. So instead of having it grow like at 3%, you'd like to grow in terms of the real economy, it goes to zero overnight. And they maintain this for, I can't remember how long, but I think about a year or so. And it's really just putting the monetary brakes on the economy in a huge and very harsh and fast way. And the timing of the gold sterilization, which they eventually did stop doing, it times perfectly with when the recession starts and when it ends. And that timing does not fit with the fiscal policy story. It doesn't really fit with the reserve requirement story. Mm-hmm. And I just do some counterfactuals on, you know, what path was the monetary base and the money supply going on before that and after that. And it just seems like it's a huge shock to the system.
It seems very convincing to me.
It was not a Fed action. It was the Treasury action.
And that's what's fascinating. Why was the Treasury concerned about inflation? I mean, that should have been the Fed's job, right? Why were they worried about inflation in the first place?
Well, once again, the Fed and the Treasury were a little bit more tied back then than today. We'd had this period of deflation. Prices had, you know, stabilized and then were coming up after we went off the gold standard. But they began to pick up in early 36. And so, surprisingly, even though we still had double-digit unemployment, there was worried about overheating.
You'd think after
the price level falling by a third, you actually wouldn't mind if it rose by a third. But instead, you know, 5 or 6%, all of a sudden alarm bells go off, and they said we have to tighten.
I mean, this couple of things. This reminds me of the Eurozone. I think the Eurozone probably fits this the best because they too underwent the Great Recession in 2008. Then in 2011, inflation is going up because of commodity prices and because they did a VAT tax there. Purely supply shock. They should have ignored, but they tightened twice in 2011. So it's very, and they were concerned about inflation. So again, the Eurozone is in the midst of just coming out of the Great Recession and they shoot themselves in the foot with these interest rate hikes because of inflation fears. The other thing it makes me think of though is the great, going back to the early part of the Great Depression. The Fed was also very conservative then, right? It was almost reluctant to be aggressive. They had a little QE there, but it really was FDR who kind of took the reins. Again, Treasury kind of took over in a more productive way. There were gold flows that were coming in and Treasury didn't sterilize them, right?
Right.
During that period.
Yeah. So this is where Christy Romer has a great paper in the Journal of Economic History on basically how monetary policy was on autopilot. It's not as though the Fed was trying to expand. We just had gold inflows and they just accommodated them. And so we got on this path, but it wasn't like they were super aggressive
and then FDR kind of also revalued the dollar or he more dollars per ounce of gold, which.
Right. So there's a lot of fiddling with the dollar price in late 1933. And then 1934, they sort of pegged it again. And then the gold inflows took us from there.
All right. Those two things. Yeah. We can't look to the Fed as an institution that saved us out of 33, 34. It was the Treasury allowing the gold to come in and not sterilizing that time. So whereas in 37, they go the other direction, which is just kind of odd. I guess
right.
33, 34, things are so bad, they're not worried about inflation. And then 37, they are.
Right. Yep.
Very fascinating. Okay. I believe our time is up. Our guest today has been Doug Irwin. Doug, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
And listeners, remember to buy his new book, Clashing Over Commerce, A History of U.S. Trade Policy. Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.